The man called Northover looked at it with unaffected interest and merely nodded. "Well, sir," said the major, breathing hard, "what about that?"
"What about it precisely?" said the man with the mustache.
"I am Major Brown," said the gentleman sternly. Northover bowed. "Pleased to meet you, sir. What have you to say to me?"
"Say," cried the major, losing a sudden tempest, "why, I want this confounded thing settled. I want..."
"Certainly, sir," said Northover, jumping up with a slight elevation of the eyebrows. "Will you take a chair for a moment?" And he pressed an electric bell just above him, which thrilled and tinkled in a room beyond. The major put his hand on the back of the chair offered him, but stood chafing and beating the floor with his polished boot. The next moment an inner glass door was opened, and a fair, weedy young man in a frock coat entered from within. "Mr. Hobson," said Northover, "this is Major Brown. Will you please finish that thing for him I gave you this morning and bring it in?"
"Yes, sir," said Mr. Hobson, and vanished like lightning.
"You'll excuse me, gentlemen," said the egregious Northover with his radiant smile, "if I continue to work until Mr. Hobson is ready. I have some books that must be cleared up before I get away on my holiday tomorrow. And we all like a whiff of the country, don't we? Ha ha." The criminal took up his pen with a childlike laugh, and a silence ensued, a placid and busy silence on the part of Mr. P.G. Northover, a raging silence on the part of everybody else. At length the scratching of Northover's pen in the stillness was mingled with a knock at the door, almost simultaneous with the turning of the handle, and Mr. Hobson came in again with the same silent rapidity, placed a paper before his principal, and disappeared again. The man at the desk pulled and twisted his spiky mustache for a few moments as he ran his eye up and down the paper presented to him. He took up his pen with a slight instantaneous frown and altered something, muttering, "Careless." Then he read it again with the same impenetrable reflectiveness, and finally handed it to the frantic Brown, whose hand was beating the devil's tattoo on the back of the chair. "I think you will find that all right, Major," he said briefly. The major looked at it. Whether he found it all right or not will appear later, but he found it like this. Major Brown to P.G. Northover, January 1 to account rendered, £5.06. May 9 to potting and embedding of zoo pansies, £2. To cost of trolley with flowers, 15p. To hiring of man with trolley, 5p. To hire of house and garden for one day, £1. To furnishing of room and peacock curtains, copper ornaments, etc., £3. To salary of Miss Jameson, £1. To salary of Mr. Plover, £1. Total £14.06. A remittance will oblige. What, said Brown, after a dead pause and with eyes that seemed slowly rising out of his head, what in heaven's name is this?
What is it? Repeated Northover, cocking his eyebrow with amusement.
It's your account, of course.
My account?
The major's ideas appeared to be in a vague stampede. My account? And what have I got to do with it?
Well, said Northover, laughing outright, naturally I prefer you to pay it.
The major's hand was still resting on the back of the chair as the words came. He scarcely stirred otherwise, but he lifted the chair bodily into the air with one hand and hurled it at Northover's head. The legs crashed against the desk so that Northover only got a blow on the elbow as he sprang up with clenched fists, only to be seized by the united rush of the rest of us. The chair had fallen clattering on the empty floor.
"Let me go, you scamps," he shouted. "Let me..."
"Stand still," cried Rupert authoritatively. "Major Brown's action is excusable. The abominable crime you have attempted..."
"A customer has a perfect right," said Northover hotly, "to question an alleged overcharge. But confound it all, not to throw furniture."
"What in God's name do you mean by your customers and overcharges?" shrieked Major Brown, whose keen feminine nature, steady in pain or danger, became almost hysterical in the presence of a long and exasperating mystery. "Who are you? I've never seen you or your insolent tomfool bills. I know one of your cursed brutes tried to choke me."
"Mad," said Northover, gazing blankly round. "All of them mad. I didn't know they traveled in quartets. Enough of this prevarication, said Rupert. Your crimes are discovered. A policeman is stationed at the corner of the court. Though only a private detective myself, I will take the responsibility of telling you that anything you say... Mad, repeated Northover with a weary air. And at this moment, for the first time, there struck in among them the strange, sleepy voice of Basil Grant. Major Brown, he said, may I ask you a question? The major turned his head with an increased bewilderment. You, he cried. Certainly, Mr. Grant. Can you tell me, said the mystic with sunken head and lowering brow, as he traced a pattern in the dust with his sword stick, can you tell me what was the name of the man who lived in your house before you? The unhappy major was only faintly more disturbed by this last and futile irrelevancy, and he answered vaguely, yes, I think so, a man named Gurney something, name with a hyphen, Gurney Brown, that was it. And when did the house change hands? Said Basil, looking up sharply. His strange eyes were burning brilliantly. I came in last month, said the major. At the mere word, the criminal Northover suddenly fell into his great office chair and shouted with a volleying laughter. Oh, it's too perfect. It's too exquisite, he gasped, beating the arms with his fists. He was laughing deafeningly. Basil Grant was laughing voicelessly, and the rest of us only felt that our heads were like weathercocks in a whirlwind. Confound it, Basil, said Rupert, stamping. If you don't want me to go mad and blow your metaphysical brains out, tell me what all this means. Northover rose. Permit me, sir, to explain, he said. And first of all, permit me to apologize to you, Major Brown, for a most abominable and unpardonable blunder, which has caused you menace and inconvenience, in which, if you will allow me to say so, you have behaved with astonishing courage and dignity. Of course you need not trouble about the bill. We will stand the loss. And tearing the paper across, he flung the halves into the waste paper basket and bowed. Poor Brown's face was still a picture of distraction. But I don't even begin to understand, he cried. What bill? What blunder? What loss? Mr. P.G. Northover advanced in the center of the room thoughtfully and with a great deal of unconscious dignity. On closer consideration, there were apparent about him other things beside a screwed mustache, especially a lean, sallow face, hawk-like, and not without a careworn intelligence. Then he looked up abruptly. Do you know where you are, Major? He said. God knows I don't, said the warrior with fervor. You are standing, replied Northover, in the office of the Adventure and Romance Agency, Limited. And what's that? Blankly inquired Brown. The man of business leaned over the back of the chair and fixed his dark eyes on the other's face. Major, said he, did you ever, as you walked along the empty street upon some idle afternoon, feel the utter hunger for something to happen, something in the splendid words of Walt Whitman, something pernicious and dread, something far removed from a puny and pious life, something unproved, something in a trance, something loosed from its anchorage and driving free? Did you ever feel that? Certainly not, said the major shortly. Then I must explain with more elaboration, said Mr. Northover with a sigh. The Adventure and Romance Agency has been started to meet a great modern desire. On every side in conversation and in literature, we hear of the desire for a larger theater of events, for something to waylay us and lead us splendidly astray. Now, the man who feels this desire for a varied life pays a yearly or a quarterly sum to the Adventure and Romance Agency. In return, the Adventure and Romance Agency undertakes to surround him with startling and weird events. As a man is leaving his front door, an excited sweep approaches him and assures him of a plot against his life. He gets into a cab and is driven to an opium den. He receives a mysterious telegram or a dramatic visit and is immediately in a vortex of incidents. A very picturesque and moving story is first written by one of the staff of distinguished novelists who are at present hard at work in the adjoining room. Yours, Major Brown, designed by our Mr. Grigsby, I consider peculiarly forcible and pointed. It is almost a pity you did not see the end of it. I need scarcely explain further the monstrous mistake. Your predecessor in your present house, Mr. Gurney Brown, was a subscriber to our agency, and our foolish clerks, ignoring alike the dignity of the hyphen and the glory of military rank, positively imagined that Major Brown and Mr. Gurney Brown were the same person. Thus, you were suddenly hurled into the middle of another man's story. "How on earth does this thing work?" asked Rupert Grant, with bright and fascinated eyes. "We believe that we are doing a noble work," said Northover warmly. "It has continually struck us that there is no element in modern life that is more lamentable than the fact that the modern man has to seek all artistic existence in a sedentary state. If he wishes to float into fairyland, he reads a book. If he wishes to dash into the thick of battle, he reads a book. If he wishes to soar into heaven, he reads a book. If he wishes to slide down the banisters, he reads a book. We give him these visions, but we give him exercise at the same time, the necessity of leaping from wall to wall, of fighting strange gentlemen, of running down long streets from pursuers, all healthy and pleasant exercises. We give him a glimpse of that great morning world of Robin Hood or the Knight's Errant, when one great game was played under the splendid sky. We give him back his childhood, that godlike time when we can act stories, be our own heroes, and at the same instant dance and dream." Basil gazed at him curiously. The most singular psychological discovery had been reserved to the end, for as the little businessman ceased speaking, he had the blazing eyes of a fanatic. Major Brown received the explanation with complete simplicity and good humor. "Of course. Awfully dense, sir," he said. "No doubt at all, the scheme excellent. But I don't think," he paused a moment and looked dreamily out of the window, "I don't think you will find me in it. Somehow, when one's seen the thing itself, you know, blood and men screaming, one feels about having a little house and a little hobby. In the Bible, you know, there remaineth a rest." Northover bowed. Then, after a pause, he said, "Gentlemen, may I offer you my card? If any of the rest of you desire at any time to communicate with me, despite Major Brown's view of the matter..." "I should be obliged for your card," said the Major, in his abrupt but courteous voice. "Pay for chair." The agent of romance and adventure handed his card, laughing. It ran, P.G. Northover, B.A., C.Q.T., Adventure and Romance Agency, 14 Tanner's Court, Fleet Street. "What on earth is C.Q.T.?" asked Rupert Grant, looking over the Major's shoulder. "Don't you know," returned Northover. "Haven't you ever heard of the Club of Queer Trades?" "There seems to be a confounded lot of funny things we haven't heard of," said the little Major reflectively. "What's this one?" "The Club of Queer Trades is a society consisting exclusively of people who have invented some new and curious way of making money. I was one of the earliest members." "You deserve to be," said Basil, taking up his great white hat with a smile and speaking for the last time that evening. When they had passed out, the adventure and romance agent wore a queer smile as he trod down the fire and locked up his desk. "A fine chap, that Major. When one hasn't a touch of the poet, one stands some chance of being a poem. But to think of such a clockwork little creature, of all people, getting into the nets of one of Grigsby's tales," and he laughed out loud in the silence. Just as the laugh echoed away, there came a sharp knock at the door. An owlish head with dark mustaches was thrust in, with deprecating and somewhat absurd inquiry. "What? Back again, Major?" cried Northover in surprise. "What can I do for you?" The Major shuffled feverishly into the room. "It's horribly absurd," he said. "Something must have got started in me that I never knew before. But upon my soul, I feel the most desperate desire to know the end of it all."
"The end of it all?"
"Yes," said the Major. "Jackals, and the title deeds, and death to Major Brown." The agent's face grew grave, but his eyes were amused. "I am terribly sorry, Major," said he, "but what you ask is impossible. I don't know anyone I would sooner oblige than you, but the rules of the agency are strict. The adventures are confidential. You are an outsider. I am not allowed to let you know an inch more than I can help. I do hope you understand." There is no one, said Brown, who understands discipline better than I do. Thank you very much. Good night. And the little man withdrew for the last time. He married Miss Jameson, the lady with the red hair and the green garments. She was an actress, employed with many others, by the romance agency. And her marriage with the prim old veteran caused some stir in her languid and intellectualized set. She always replied very quietly that she had met scores of men who acted splendidly in the charades provided for them by Northover, but that she had only met one man who went down into a coal cellar when he really thought it contained a murderer. The major and she are living as happily as birds in an absurd villa, and the former has taken to smoking. Otherwise he is unchanged, except perhaps there are moments when, alert and full of feminine unselfishness, as the major is by nature, he falls into a trance of abstraction. Then his wife recognizes with a concealed smile, by the blind look in his blue eyes, that he is wondering what were the title deeds, and why he was not allowed to mention jackals. But like so many old soldiers, Brown is religious and believes that he will realize the rest of those purple adventures in a better world. Chapter 2. The Painful Fall of a Great Reputation. Basil Grant and I were talking one day in what is perhaps the most perfect place for talking on earth, the top of a tolerably deserted tram car. To talk on the top of a hill is superb, but to talk on the top of a flying hill is a fairy tale. The vast blank space of North London was flying by. The very pace gave us a sense of its immensity and its meanness. It was, as it were, a base infinitude, a squalid eternity, and we felt the real horror of the poor parts of London, the horror that is so totally missed and misrepresented by the sensational novelists who depict it as being a matter of narrow streets, filthy houses, criminals and maniacs, and dens of vice. In a narrow street, in a den of vice, you do not expect civilization. You do not expect order. But the horror of this was the fact that there was civilization, that there was order, but that civilization only showed its morbidity, and order only its monotony. No one would say, in going through a criminal slum, I see no statues, I notice no cathedrals. But here there were public buildings, only they were mostly lunatic asylums. Here there were statues, only they were mostly statues of railway engineers and philanthropists, two dingy classes of men united by their common contempt for the people. Here there were churches, only they were the churches of dim and erratic sects, Agapemonites, or Irvingites. Here, above all, there were broad roads and vast crossings and tramway lines and hospitals and all the real marks of civilization. But though one never knew, in one sense, what one would see next, there was one thing we knew we should not see. Anything really great, central, of the first class, anything that humanity had adored. And with revulsion indescribable, our emotions returned, I think, to those really close and crooked entries, to those really mean streets, to those genuine slums which lie round the Thames and the city, in which nevertheless a real possibility remains that at any chance corner the great cross of the great cathedral of Wren may strike down the street like a thunderbolt. But you must always remember also, said Grant to me in his heavy, abstracted way, when I had urged this view, that the very vileness of the life of these ordered plebeian places bears witness to the victory of the human soul. I agree with you. I agree that they have to live in something worse than barbarism. They have to live in a fourth-rate civilization. But yet I am practically certain that the majority of people here are good people, and being good is an adventure far more violent and daring than sailing round the world. Besides, go on, I said. No answer came. Go on, I said, looking up. The big blue eyes of Basil Grant were standing out of his head, and he was paying no attention to me. He was staring over the side of the tram. What is the matter? I asked, peering over also. It is very odd, said Grant at last grimly, that I should have been caught out like this at the very moment of my optimism. I said all these people were good, and there is the wickedest man in England.
Where? I asked, leaning over further. Where?